Brandon Spencer Hartle.
Good afternoon,
Brandon.
Chair Livingston and members of the Commission. I'm excited to be here today. Brandon Spencer Hartle, Historic Resources Manager at the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability.
Very nice to see you.
Yeah, you too. It's been a little while. So I've had the fortune of talking to a few of you or being CC'd on emails to a few of you in the last couple of days about this project. But what I'd like to do is spend about a half an hour giving the Commission an update on the Historic Resources Code project, why we're doing it, what we're proposing, and where we're going. And then leave it open for 20 minutes or so of question and discussion for anything that sparks your interest. And if it's okay with you, Chair Livingston, I'm going to share my screen.
Perfect.
And are you able to see that okay?
Yep.
Great. So like I said, I'll take us on a quick review of the background, the proposals, where we're going. Given time limitations, I won't get into detail about every little piece of the project, but I'll give you the highlights. And then at the end, I do have three areas that I think will be maybe special interest to the Design Commission based upon your work on the DOZA project and your future casework as it might relate to historic resources or potentially overlap or intersect with the Landmarks Commission's work. So a couple of reasons why we're here. I know many of you have heard earlier versions of this dog and pony show before, but why we're here is citywide. It's been about 36 years since there's been a comprehensive effort to update the citywide historic resources inventory. Many of our counterpart large cities regularly work on identifying and evaluating historic resources citywide so that we have good information available to the public. And a sort of a list of the lowest hanging fruit for potential historic designations. We haven't done that since the 1980s for a few reasons. This project is seeking to move us out of neutral on that opportunity to get out and be more active in identifying potential historic resources and working with the community. It's been a little over 7 years since the last time there were refinements to the exemptions, thresholds, and procedures related to historic resource review and the community design standards and conservation districts. And so in alignment similar to DOZA with where we're trying to go with ensuring that the reviews are appropriate for the scale of proposed project and for projects that have come in recently that maybe ought to be exemptions, we're going to build off of what was last done in 2013 to continue to look for ways to improve specifically historic resource review, but also the demolition review process. 3 years ago, and I think this is about the last time I came before the Design Commission to talk about historic resources, the Land Conservation and Development Commission for the state of Oregon adopted new administrative rules governing historic resource protections at the local level. That change in administrative rules did two things. One, it changed the land use effect of listing a property in the National Register of Historic Places, which I'll talk about in a minute. And two, it provided us with new flexibility in the zoning code to better manage historic resources, both from the regulatory side to the incentive side. And so we're using that change in state admin rule to one, become compliant with state law, and two, seek to implement some of that new flexibility in hopes of better aligning historic resources programs with our new comprehensive plan, which became effective 2 years ago. Over the last 3 years, we've talked to just under 1,000 property owners, tenants, staff, and multiple bureaus and agencies, looked at 13 cities nationally about what their best practices are, and tried to identify opportunities to improve the way that the Historic Resources Program works, both from the regulatory side to the incentive side, and then really thinking about how can we be the most efficient, the most thoughtful about how we protect historic places. Where we're going is 2 weeks ago, we released the proposed draft of the Historic Resources Code project. That proposed draft is out for public review between now and October 27th. Your colleagues on the Historic Landmarks Commission have been heavily involved in drafting that proposal, as have Bureau Development Services staff on Tim, Kara, and Stacy's team. So we've worked together over the last couple of years to refine some of the proposals, to workshop some areas that they're moving us in, we think, a reasonable direction in some cases. But now that's out for public review, and why I'm here today is just to give you a sense of what those core proposals are. We'll have a hearing before the Planning and Sustainability Commission on October 27th, and we're hoping to make it to City Council in spring 2021. In many ways, this project is DOZA for historic resources, even though DOZA does touch a little bit on the administration of how Historic Resource Review works, now the Landmarks Commission conducts their business. This project has been intended to sort of follow on the coattails of DOZA to bring a similar set of improvements to the historic resource rules. So we will likely end up a council right after DOZA for an effective date sometime in the middle of 2021. In DOZA, as I think some of you know, and maybe were involved in, the DOZA team advanced 5 value statements, and we're doing something similar with the Historic Resources Code project. We took a look at state administrative rule. We looked at our comprehensive plan. We looked at what the PELF People's Plan and other relevant community plans were telling us about why historic places matter, and did want to lead with 5 value statements about the City of Portland's commitment to historic resources, why we're proposing some of the changes that are included in the Historic Resources Code project, and where we think future preservation efforts may be best serving communities and resource types that have been underrepresented, and allowing for the extension of the useful life of historic buildings through flexibility and adaptive reuse opportunities. And so these are the 5 value statements we landed on at the staff level that we think underlie the core proposals. And then I've got 2 slides here of just background context. I know some of you on the commission are very familiar with this. Others may be new to the historic resources world. In the state of Oregon, owner consent is a requirement to designate a landmark, and a majority owner consent is required to create a district. That law dates back to 1995. And so what it's meant is that any individual property that's seeking any level of designation does need to bring with it the owner's signature supporting that designation. It puts us in a different spot in Oregon than any other state in the country. And it also gives us, a unique opportunity to think about the value of incentives for encouraging property owners that have special historic places to consider a historic designation. And so in these code proposals, we're not proposing any financial incentives. We don't have a pot of money to give, but we are looking for ways that we can use the zoning code as one tool to get those owners of the most historic and significant places receptive to a landmark designation in the future. Portland, since the 1990s and up until 2017, relied nearly exclusively on a federal designation, the National Register of Historic Places, to convey local historic landmark and district status. So many of you may have worked on projects or are familiar with projects that maybe are in the Northwest 13th Avenue Historic District in the Pearl, or the Irvington Historic District in Northeast, or maybe worked on a project with the Old Multnomah County Courthouse or the Baghdad Theater. The vast majority of Portland's historic landmarks and districts are so designated because they were listed in the National Register at a time when, prior to 2017, that federal listing automatically conveyed the status of historic landmark or historic district and the protection programs that come along with that. I'll talk more about that in a minute. But when the state changed the administrative rules 3 years ago, we were given an opportunity to think of the National Register a little differently in response to the discussions that have gone on in places like Eastmoreland, Laurelhurst, previously Irvington, about what greater public involvement and the weighing and balancing of citywide goals and policies might look like in creating districts. And so as of 2017, Oregon law still requires cities to apply demolition protections to new listings in the National Register. Billy Webb Elks Lodge up in Northeast Portland is one of those new listings. But local governments can no longer automatically or no longer are required to automatically convey historic landmark and district status upon listing in the National Register. And I'll explain that in a few slides here in a minute with some more visuals that sort of help explain what that change means. Effectively, that change means that we have places that were designated in the past and places that get designated in the future. And this code project has the cumbersome bureaucratic job of figuring out how best to convey that on our official zoning map and to apply regulations to those different types of designations. Again, I'll explain that in a minute. I mentioned a minute or two ago that in 1984, there was this big citywide effort to update the inventory. Previous to 2017, that state owner consent law meant that the city was not in a position to evaluate resources for potential historic significance without owner consent. And so while the Historic Landmarks Commission and city council members for many years have been desiring a citywide update to that inventory, a lack of clarity around the scope of the law, and our existing zoning code language has meant that the city was not in a position to go and document, survey, evaluate resources for potential historic significance without every individual owner consenting to that. Essentially, that's put us in a sort of a neutral position on going out and looking for places that might have historic significance, that might be good candidates for landmark designation. And these code amendments, and I'll explain in a minute, seek to allow the city to evaluate, document and evaluate resources, not always with owner consent. So allowing that to be more of a typical land use process where, let's say as an area plan study or a thematic study of a group of properties, those properties could be documented, evaluated for historic significance without owner consent. They could not be designated as landmarks or put into a historic district without the owners being involved. And the last thing I'll say here is the 2017 changes in rules really give us a new opportunity for applying different and creative designation processes, protections, and use incentives to our city designated landmarks and districts. Today, citywide, we have several categories of historic resources. It's not a one-size-fits-all program, though the historic landmark and historic district designation types really have been the primary ones. But citywide, we have about 735 individual historic landmark buildings. These are places like the St. John Signal gas station or the Jackson Tower downtown, the Broadway Bridge and the Paul Bunyan, Baghdad Theater, and a variety of buildings in the Central East Side. Buildings that have individually been identified as historic landmarks, most of which also are on the National Register of Historic Places, 10 of which were listed in the National Register after 2017, and they're treated a little differently. I'll explain what we're going to do with that in a minute, since it will relate to your work as design commissioners. We have 12 buildings, which is not that many, citywide, that were designated locally as conservation landmarks. And the idea of the conservation landmark, and it's similar to the conservation district, was that they're places that have historic significance, that meet a bar of importance for the community, but that might not be appropriate for the highest level of protections that come with historic landmark status. The language that was used when the conservation level of designation was conceived of back in the 1970s was historic, but less than landmark. And so the thought here is that these are kind of like the character buildings that I know this commission has talked about in DOZA. They're places that are important, that have some architectural, social, cultural value, but may not be appropriate to protect at the highest level. There's only 12 of them citywide. It's really been a bit of a forgotten designation type for quite a while. These code amendments are seeking to bring back interest in conservation landmark designation as essentially a silver standard of designation. We have 20 historic districts citywide. Some of those are the familiar ones like the Ladd's Additions or the Skidmore Old Towns, but other ones are places like the Rocky Butte Scenic Drive or Mount Tabor Reservoirs. Citywide, we have 20 historic districts. And then I mentioned the conservation landmarks. We also have 6 conservation districts. Those are all in North and Northeast Portland. Some of our historic districts had formerly been conservation districts that evolved up to historic districts. But the 6 conservation districts today are places like Piedmont, Woodlawn, Mississippi, Elliott, Kenton. And then we have a little under 1,000 buildings that were identified as having significance in the 1984 inventory effort. They were given a ranking of eligibility for landmark status, but those owners have elected not to designate those buildings, and/or they've been altered over time or might not be appropriate for landmarks. So those are the ones that sort of have some significance but aren't included as one of the designated types. And then one last background slide, then I'll start to get into how all this stuff fits together. There's 4 primary tools that Bureau of Development Services and the Landmarks Commission use to protect historic resources. I'm not going to talk at great length about all of these, but generally the 4 tools that we have codified to protect historic resources are demolition review, demolition delay, historic resource review, which I think all of you know, but it's effectively design review for historic places. And then in some areas, the conservation districts and for the conservation landmarks, we do have a clear and objective alternative path in the community design standards that can be followed. So kind of similar to what all of you are expert in, but a little different in that we have demolition protections that apply to many of our historic landmarks and in historic districts. That's a land use review that currently requires city council approval before a historic landmark or a contributing historic feature in a historic district can be demolished. Pretty rare that anyone asks the question, but that there have been situations where city council has approved demolitions through demo review. The conservation districts and conservation landmarks are currently subject to demolition delay, which is just a 120-day administrative delay period. Historic districts, conservation districts, historic landmarks, conservation districts are subject to historic resource review for alterations, additions, and new construction. And then in the conservation districts, a property owner is able to elect the clear and objective community design standards as an alternate path. So similar to your work, a little different flavor. These are generally our four ways we protect historic resources citywide. That's my background. I'm gonna move into where we're going, what the core proposals are and why we're advancing those. I think Chair Livingston, if I might pause just for a quick second, if there's any questions from you or your fellow commissioners.
Oh, thank you very much. Commissioners, any questions? Okay. Is that Chandra?
No, I was just saying no, not for me.
Okay, thank you.
No.
Brandon, I want to be sure that I understand, because this is all new to me. I'm one of the commissioners that is really not familiar with this. Conservation is local to the city of Portland.
Correct.
Okay.
And I've got just a slide for you and two slides to
show
you how it all fits together.
Perfect. Thank you.
So one thing that, and I'll just keep rolling here and we'll come back to that. One thing that has happened in my tenure at the city, before I was at the city and for a long time, has been confusion about the different resource types, what they mean, how they fit together, what's the inventory, what's a landmark. And so at the 30,000 foot view, what we're seeking to do with these proposals is to clarify, organize, and streamline what the different resource types, what they are, how they're hierarchically organized in terms of the protections that apply, and what options are available for property owners and decision makers who are considering future listings as a landmark, a district, or evaluating significance. And so to do that, we've re-engineered what the historic resource inventory means. And for a long time, the inventory has been a status, a resource type of places that have been documented for significance but not designated. And people get confused when we say, well, your Irvington Historic District is not part of the inventory because it's designated. So at the foundational level, we're moving to really clarify that all historic resources are part of our inventory. And within that inventory, some are protected, some are not. And the ones that are protected at different levels. And we're moving to a gold, silver, bronze type approach to those protections that correspond logically and hierarchically with the different protections I mentioned earlier. So at a fundamental level, the first proposal is we really want to get the language clear and put ourselves in a position where for the public, for property owners, for realtors, for architects, engineers, that we have clear terminology and that the zoning code can follow that clear terminology in a way that makes more sense than it does today. And to do that, we would be thinking about a hierarchy of historic resources that aligns with protection programs. We do get direction from the state that properties that are listed in the National Register of Historic Places must have demolition review, that we must have a public hearing and consider their demolition, but that local governments beyond that have flexibility to choose how best they want to protect historic resources that might be listed at the local level. Today, our strongest protections, demolition review, historic resource review, apply only to those places that are listed in the National Register. So our historic landmarks and historic districts that are on the National Register are treated today in the code as our gold standard. Our city-designated historic landmarks and city-designated historic districts don't have demo review. They just have demo delay. They have historic resource review. And then our conservation landmarks and conservation districts have the demolition delay and the two-track design standards and guidelines. Over the course of the last 3 years, we've heard from a variety of people, people who live in conservation districts, who own historic landmarks, who live in areas that have been considered for National Register listing, and people who have concerns about the sort of policy implications of historic designation. And so in order to come up with a clearer system of how we protect historic resources, we are proposing a change in the hierarchy to streamline and more logically organize the different resource types. In this project, we're not proposing to create any new historic landmarks. We're not proposing to remove any historic landmarks or conservation landmarks, But what we are trying to do is to be more thoughtful and efficient around what the types are and what the levels of protections are that apply to them. What this would do is to effectively have properties that are listed in the National Register in the future be identified no longer as our gold standard of protection, but as our bronze standard of protection. So if in the future there were an Eastmoreland Historic District that were designated, we would follow the minimum state requirements for applying demo review. But in order for us to apply any design controls to that area, it would need to have a overlapping local conservation or historic district designation. So the thought is National Register listing in the future, because it's not a city process and there hasn't been a broad public conversation about weighing citywide goals and policies, the National Register would effectively be the foot in the door for potential local designation. That would be for both individual landmarks and for districts. Because Oregon requires owner consent for designation, we would need to have an owner or the majority of owners consent to move up this ladder. But by having a hierarchy organized in this way, the city and the decision makers would have more ability to think creatively about what the best level of protection for a resource might look like.
Brenda, can I ask a question about this?
Yeah.
So for the bronze, silver, and gold levels, what are the bodies that confer this status for each level?
Very good question. This is why you must be the chair, because you're like one slide ahead of me.
Okay.
You're just
I retract.
The perfect work of the chair of being like, where are you going? And so in order for us to make this work, we want to have the right criteria and the right process for making these decisions. The city doesn't have much control over the National Register listing process. Our Historic Landmarks Commission, they do review any proposed listing in the National Register, but their scope of review is narrow. It's just looking at, does this meet the criteria for federal listing? Specifically, they're not invited to weigh whether or not any regulatory consequences conferred by state law are appropriate or not. They're just asked, is this significant or not? So under this new framework, and it's what the state contemplated 3 years ago with their new rules, the city will need to play a more proactive role in making designation decisions at that gold and silver level. And the designation decisions are both decisions to list, but also decisions to remove, because we do occasionally have properties that maybe there was a fire in the property, maybe the history of the property isn't worthy of preservation and protection any longer. That we do have interest occasionally in a resource being considered for removal from its designation. So in order to make this work, and in order to be thoughtful about whose histories are elevated to the level of significance to be moved up to the silver and gold standard, and who the right decision-making body is, we are proposing an overhaul of how each level of designation operates. I'm going to just tab forward a few here to get to this slide. To do that, we are proposing new criteria for resources to be listed as a historic or conservation landmark or district. Those criteria are informed by state law, but also include our comprehensive plan goals and policies related to preservation equity, to thinking about underrepresented resource types that might not be significant for architecture, but looking at social, cultural, ethnic, community history as being underrepresented today and really worthy of designation, needing to think a little more broadly about how we evaluate that, as well as the process for considering removal. So what criteria we use, and essentially the criteria that used for proposing a removal of landmark or district status would be the reverse of the criteria used to designate. So is a resource no longer appropriate for designation given the designation criteria? You ask a good question about the process. Since the city hasn't played an active role in designations for about 25 years, most of our counterpart cities are expert in local designations. We're the unique big city in the country that's relied on the National Register for a long time. And now we've got to look at our counterpart cities for what they do. And so we are proposing new land use procedures for both quasi-judicial and legislative actions to designate resources. To create or remove any new conservation or historic districts, we are proposing that be a legislative decision made by the Portland City Council, that we wouldn't be creating any new historic districts without a city council vote, nor would we be removing any existing historic or conservation districts without the city council's involvement, that it would be legislative and not quasi-judicial. For individual landmark structures, so for example, if let's say, I'll use Tim. Let's say Tim wanted to make his house a historic landmark. Tim could choose to do that quasi-judicially by going to the Landmarks Commission and making the case that, that his property has met the criteria. We have seen a number of properties that get listed on the National Register, so they're coming in at that bronze level, who are receptive to or even desiring historic or conservation landmark status. We're trying to make it really easy for those individual owners who are trying to seek historic or conservation landmark status. And so if they're listed in the National Register individually and they consent, it would be a type one staff level review to have those become a historic or conservation landmark. I think I'll pause there. Chair Livingston, did you have a follow-up?
Yes. So at this point where historic or conservation status goes to City Council, at that point, what is the difference between historic and conservation status?
I'm loving your one slide ahead of me. Thank you.
Okay. Okay, I retract.
So our thought process is, okay, from the biggest level, let's get the names right. Let's get the, you know, the thought of the inventory right. Come up with our menu of resource types. We'll organize those resource types in a logical way. It's hierarchical. And then to make the hierarchy work, we want to take a look at the full suite of protections. And the one area in protections that we've heard has not been working is demolition delay. And we've heard this in the conservation districts, and we've heard this in areas of the city that would be interested in conservation district status as an alternative to historic district status, if not for demolition delay. And so we've heard time and time again that the demolition delay, given our current economic situation and the inability for demolition delay to result in alternatives to demolition or meaningful negotiation, we've heard that the practical effect of demolition delay is that the resources don't get conserved. The demolition review and public hearing, the ability to weigh criteria, is a necessary piece of the puzzle to protect resources. And so the big regulatory swing in these code amendments would be to apply demolition review to all conservation landmarks and all contributing resources in conservation districts, where today they're just subject to delay, to ensure that there's meaningful public involvement whenever a designated resource, that's city designated, at even at the solver level, is considered for demolition. And we think that's important because state law does confer that to National Register listing. And it may not always be appropriate for a resource to be listed in the National Register, or there may be areas of the city that are worthy of designation whose owners, to ensure the full involvement of the community, or to engage with decision makers, or would prefer a local designation than a national designation. To have that local designation bring with it demolition review is something we've heard is really important. And to make that work, we're proposing to have additional approval criteria for demolition review related to mitigation that supports the district's architecture, culture, social history, and refining the procedure types that apply to demolition review so that the demolition review criteria and process follows with that hierarchy. That it's harder to demolish a historic landmark than it is to demolish a conservation landmark. It's harder to demolish a conservation landmark than it is to demolish a National Register landmark. That the demolition protections scale up as you go up that ladder, with all designated resources subject to demolition review. And similarly, on the design piece, the state law says that listing in the National Register into the future by and of itself does not convey any design protections. Today's conservation level is a two-track approach. So you can pick from the clear and objective community design standards or elect historic resource review. And then at that historic level, the gold standard, we're saying historic resource review is required. We've heard from a lot of people that they kind of like that, the shades of design protection, that National Register alone, you know, you've got full design flexibility if you're not demolishing. Conservation, you've got the two-track. And then for historic, maybe our most protected resources, you're going for historic resource review. And so we're proposing to keep that general approach that as you go up from bronze, silver to gold, you incrementally, sort of as almost like a nesting doll situation, you have more and more regulation as you go up the ladder. But we have heard both in conservation districts and historic districts that we have a lot of opportunity to expand exemptions. We tracked along with DOZA and we tracked along with recent land use reviews and took a look at where we might be able to flex a little bit for new exemptions. And so at all levels where there are design protections, we are proposing expanding exemptions. We're not contracting exemptions. We're only expanding exemptions. And we're doing it in a way that we think won't harm the historic features permanently of these resources, but that do respond to routine small additions and alterations. A couple big ones that we're proposing would be to exempt solar panels in historic districts on roof slopes that don't face down to the street. So that's a big change, and we've heard mixed feedback on that. But today, to do solar panels in a historic district does require a historic resource review. We went around and around with this with a variety of stakeholders and internally, and are moving in a direction of allowing solar panels in historic districts, provided they're not on a roof slope that faces the street, and provided those panels are tied up against the roof. That's a big change. Another big change is in historic districts, we're proposing to allow 400 square foot detached accessory structures without review. So you could do a small ADU in the backyard. There's a couple of design standards we've applied to that, but the general idea is if you're building a small ADU in the backyard, or you're looking to do solar, we would flex there. Long list of other exemptions related to internal service chimneys and basement windows, vents, mechanical, landscaping. So we really are thinking how to make life easier for owners, tenants, and designers in historic districts and conservation districts. And then we are proposing some refinements to the historic resource review approval criteria that are used for landmarks and in districts without district-specific guidelines. In the interest of time, I'm not going to talk too much about this, but log it in your brain, and in three slides, I'm going to come back to it. Because one thing that we have today is conservation landmarks. There's only 12 of them. But conservation landmarks are subject to the same criteria as historic landmarks. So if a conservation landmark owner elects to go through historic resource review, they say, we're not going to follow the community design standards, we're going to historic resource review, they would follow the same approval criteria as an individual historic landmark structure. So we haven't really worked the hierarchy out there with the protections. We are proposing new criteria for alterations, additions, and new constructions to conservation landmarks, anticipating a future where more owners might think about that. And what we've really tried to do here is run with the character building idea that conservation landmarks as less than historic landmark, but still important, may be an appropriate place for us to allow for a little more design flexibility for additions and alterations than we've seen in the past. And I'll cue that up for discussion in a minute. But the thought process is, let's refine our historic resource review approval criteria. We've worked with the Landmarks Commission on this. And let's really think about that bronze or the silver level of conservation being a little more of a release valve on where you could be more creative than we've typically seen with historic landmarks. Questions on this one? I know we're covering a lot of ground, and we could get into the details. But...
I do have a question, actually. You know, I really appreciate a lot of your explanation, and up to this point of your presentation, you are trying to address some of the questions that both Julie and I've actually had. But one thing that is really difficult is that to, in a very simplistic way, have a better understanding of what are the distinction between them, what are the hierarchies, and how people can really review and see what the requirements are. So I think I am not questioning your values or what you're looking into. What I would like to tell you is that I am having a hard time following what you're explaining, and I'm hoping, and I'm sure the public probably would have the same issue. And are there ways that your ideas in these studies could be presented in a more simplistic and visual manner that is understandable, a little bit more understandable?
Yeah, I think that's good feedback, Commissioner Zanter. I think one thing that we have is sort of the delicate balance of somebody who maybe has one property or is a tenant and they're looking at it through one lens, and a policy-oriented group like this group who's thinking about what's the big picture and how does it fit together. So I think that's really helpful feedback for me when we go to the other for policy-minded bodies who I'll be presenting to. So I'll make a note of that and see what we can do.
Good, thank you.
Yeah, I have a quick question also. How does a building owner know if their building is in one of these categories or not? I mean, do you send notification to the property owner, or how does this work?
Yeah, good question. So similar to the D overlay for design review, any property that's a historic resource, either a landmark, part of a district, a resource that's been identified as having potential significance, those are all included in the historic resource overlay zone. So if you're on Portland Maps and you go to the zoning and districts, you would see this as an overlay zone. And then from there, you would go and find, you know, what's the applicable regulation. We did send mailed notice to every historic resource owner last week to let them know that there were proposed changes. That Measure 56 notice was a pretty vague reminder to people that, hey, you're in a historic area and you might want to look at the proposed changes. If ever there were a proposal to add a new landmark or district designation, under these proposals, there'd be at least one and likely multiple rounds of mailed notice. And as I mentioned, owner consent would be required. So it wouldn't be something that could happen without the owner's signature.
I happen to have received one of those notifications, but I was unable to go into the system and find out the implications for my particular piece of property. So it indicated there that there was a simple process to determine that. But in fact, the little unit in the your guide did not show what the written information had indicated should be there. So I still don't know what the situation is with my particular piece of property.
Yeah, and Don, I know I got either an email or a voicemail from you. Yeah. I know you're on my callback list, so you're going to hear from me as soon as I get down to whatever day you emailed. Once I make it to that one, you're gonna hear from me about that.
So from a billing owner standpoint, it'd be nice to have clarification so they understand exactly where they are in this whole hierarchy and what the implications are for them as individual owners.
Yeah. And we did have a few people who had trouble with our map, and you may have been one of those people who had trouble with the map. So I know we've gone and tried to get some of those bugs worked out, but you should be able to go on now the map and click on your property and see exactly what your status is as it exists today and as it's proposed to change.
Okay. All right.
I'm going to roll here, if that's okay with Commissioner Livingston, and just have two more slides, and we will steer into some questions and opportunity for me to chat some more with everybody. One thing that we talk about a lot, and the Landmarks Commission's work almost exclusively lives in this world, and historic preservation advocates and people interested in designation or historic or conservation district status are generally thinking about is designation equals protection. So the most common discussions are, you know, what does a designation do to protect a property or protect the district from demolition or alteration? And, you know, we've got these code proposals to do that. But we think it's just as important to think about how can we make historic resources valuable to continue their useful life, to give property owners new, creative, interesting things that they can do with their properties, especially in a moment where it's not as though the city has real dollars to hand out to historic property owners. And so one of the core proposals that we think sort of helps tie this together in a bow is really looking to give owners of historic resources considerable use flexibility and opportunities for adapting their buildings to new and creative uses. And that would be across zones generally, and really thinking about if historic resources are providing a public benefit, there's a reason why we regulate these places, then to the extent that we can have the public learn from, enjoy, interpret, experience these places, those resources will be doing a better job serving their purpose of informing the city and being there for the future to be useful reminders of the past, but also continuing to build their history and their story. And so there's a couple ways that we're proposing to allow for greater adaptive reuse and greater flexibility for interpretation. One, and this is not a huge deal since our city council has moved in this direction in many areas of the city already, we are proposing to exempt all landmarks and all districts from parking requirements. And so to allow for historic buildings that maybe never had parking on the site or infill that wants to better follow historic patterns to be viable and to follow the architectural or cultural significance of the district, we would eliminate any required parking. Parking would still be allowed, but we would not be requiring it in our historic areas. We're proposing to make a big move in allowing by right and and discretionary additional uses that aren't otherwise allowed by zones. And this is something we've talked about a lot. It was discussed quite a bit in the residential infill and better housing by design projects. But knowing that historic landmarks, historic districts, potentially under these code amendments to conservation level, have demolition controls and design controls that aren't present elsewhere in the city, we think at the staff level, there's a big opportunity to balance those controls with allowing for more uses than are otherwise allowed in the underlying zoning. And a flavor of what those adaptive reuse incentives might look like would be that we would go beyond RIP in the number of dwelling units that would be allowed in historic and conservation districts. The design requirements and the demolition requirements would still be at play, so you wouldn't be demolishing historic contributing buildings to do it. But the thought is if an owner in a place like Irvington or Ladd's Addition in a residential zone was interested in doing a big internal conversion of a house to 4, 6, 7 units, that we would be moving more towards a form-based approach to residential density in our historic areas. Thinking again about trying to maximize the viability of the historic resources, but also giving people opportunities to live in these districts, to engage with the districts. And even more to the point, in single dwelling zones, regardless of the number of primary dwelling units, owners would always be allowed 2 accessory dwelling units. And so I mentioned earlier, we're proposing about small backyard ADUs without review. Some of the thought here is you might have a larger house in Irvington, Ladd's, Kings Hill, and you may either convert that house to multiple dwelling units or keep the house, but you would always be given 2 ADUs that you could have on the property. And if they're small, they wouldn't be subject to any review. One of the bigger swings that we're proposing, if not maybe the biggest swing in this use discussion, is near transit. So within 500 feet of transit, we're proposing to allow by right accessory commercial uses in residential zones. So if you're in the Irvington Historic District and you have a house that's fronting Northeast 15th, and you have a garage that's not used, and you're looking to rent that garage out to a massage parlor or a small cafe or something creative, we are proposing to allow accessory commercial uses in residential zones, provided there's no loss in dwelling units on the site, and provided that off-site impacts are managed. And so the idea would be moving a little more towards creative adaptive reuse flexibility, not totally turning that spigot all the way to commercial use, but thinking about accessory commercial uses near transit. For individual landmark properties in residential zones, we'd even go a little further. So if you had like the Harry Green Mansion in Laurelhurst, or if you had a large, like the Mock House on North Willamette Boulevard, an individual landmark building in a residential zone, provided you were meeting the historic resource review expectations for alterations, we would allow for the loss of residential units and the full commercial or office use of that building. And so this is getting a little more, moving a little more into the uncomfortable zone for use. But the thought is big landmark properties, if we want to see them preserved and want to see the public have access, we're looking for ways to make it work better towards that end. And then we'd even go a little further for projects like the Kennedy School or Revolution Hall, so properties where major adaptive reuse made sense, where something like a major event facility or something that was beyond a typical retail sale and service use.
Even his room on his bookshelf.
Could be allowed if a property owner went before the hearings officer for a public hearing and a weighing of impacts off-site and consistency with area plans. So that's sort of our idea, is that we want to loosen up use flexibility. We want to think about how we can have some new and creative uses, and especially for landmarks, give them a competitive advantage to be adaptively reused. The last proposal is sort of DOZA-esque, where we're proposing changes to purpose statements, procedure types, associated language throughout the code. We really are looking at DOZA as an example of where the Planning and Sustainability Commission and your commission have gone in recent months. Recognizing that historic resources are a different animal. So we're not exempting, large facade area from review, but we are looking at the thresholds and thinking about how we can better align, impact the project with the level of review, and thinking about where we might have purpose statements that could better support what those reviews are trying to do. And so one of the bigger changes is buildings that are of a house size or smaller, or sort of middle housing size, would be a staff level review, no longer a historic landmarks commission review. Larger projects can still go to the commission. So that's only a few projects a year, but just thinking about the level of impact and the review required, we are making a few tweaks there. And then we're following suit with what is in DOZA for commission membership, keeping the commission membership the same, but we're broadening the membership categories and giving some more flexibility for the recruitment process. I'm gonna stop. I know we're probably getting a little later on time than I had hoped, but there were three things that I wanted to leave the design commission with just to noodle on, think about. We haven't talked about it before, and I wanna bring them to your attention that are about your work and where you're going in the future. Those significant resources that have been identified as being historically significant, added to the HRI, but not designated as landmarks, they're not subject to historic resource review. And the same will be true with properties and districts that are listed in the National Register, but don't have a city status. There's an example of one here on the right that was recently listed in the National Register over on Southeast Stark. For that group of resources, the Landmarks Commission would not be the review body for alterations and related new construction. You would be the review body if it were in a D overlay and an applicant chose to move forward with the design review. And for the significant resources, that is familiar. You've had these reviews before with a ranked property in the HRI that comes before you. More and more, you will likely see National Register landmarks and districts coming before you in the central city or in a mixed-use zone for the design review, even though that building is subject to demolition protections. And we've talked about this quite a bit at the staff level. From state law, it's clear to us that the only effect that National Register listing can have is the demolition protection. And in that hierarchy, it's pretty clear to us that we would want to give flexibility to those owners. It's not otherwise afforded to the silver and gold standard. So this may be an area that is going to be new or different to you, where you might have a National Register landmark property owner who comes in and is proposing a large rooftop addition or a large related new construction. And I want to flag that now. I think at the staff level, we recognize it, we see it. And this is where we are feeling most comfortable given state law and that hierarchy of resource types. For the commission, I want you to be aware of it in case it causes alarm or if you see a better way.
Brandon, in conversations with Historic Landmarks Commission, what has been the position of commissioners on HLC with respect to who does this review? Which body?
Really good question. We've had the experience of the significant resources before where your commission has asked the Landmarks Commission to bring their expertise to the table. And you know, I would leave it up to Tim, Stacy, and Kara to matchmake on that process. But as I've envisioned a similar thing where maybe the Landmarks Commission provides expertise to the design commission, but that your approval criteria for either central city fundamentals or the citywide design guidelines would still be the approval criteria rather than a historic resource review approval criteria.
And the commissioners on Historic Landmarks Commission did not express a desire to own this review process for significant resources in National Register landmarks?
To date, they have not. As the discussions unfold, that might change, but to date, they have not. And many of these will be in areas that aren't subject to any review. So this would just be a D overlay.
Yeah.
When one happens to be in a D overlay, that's where it would come to fruition. There was a lot of discussion about character buildings in DOZA. I was particularly interested and sympathetic with the character building discussion, and some of that got lost from the standards and guidelines. But I think as we've heard from people about this sort of gold, silver, bronze, you know, menu of options about resources, conservation landmarks continued to come up as a type of resource that people were really envisioning as a character type building, that they're places that really are significant, but that there's interest in a resource type that can allow for a little more give than historic landmarks. And so we are proposing new approval criteria for historic resource review. So it would be discretionary that would allow sort of a character building type approach for conservation landmarks. The criteria place an emphasis on materials, architectural features, and the historic materials, and they de-emphasize the importance of compatibility for an addition. And so we'll see how it plays out. Today there's only 12 conservation landmarks. I think going into the future, if we get the criteria right, we get the incentives right, there might be quite a bit of property owner interest in, again, consenting or voluntarily pursuing conservation landmark status as a more flexible option than we've had available in the past that could get you some of the incentives and a little more flexibility than full historic resource review at the highest level of compatibility. I think we were going down this road when the character building discussion had happened at your commission, at PSC for Landmarks Commission. And increasingly we felt like to get that hierarchy right, moving in that direction might be the appropriate thing to do at that bronze level. And then one thing, I know this came up with this group, it's come up with Landmarks Commission. There's a lot of interest in learning from DOZA and revising the community design standards that apply in conservation districts. Once DOZA is adopted by council and your new standards are adopted, the existing community design standards become this vestigial set of regulations that would only apply in conservation districts. And so one follow-up item we've identified, it was identified in DOZA, is that once we get that sort of big picture hierarchy right, once we get the protection level right, a future work item, it's not budgeted, we haven't scoped it yet, but a likely future work item would be, let's learn from DOZA, let's go look at those conservation districts, and let's take the existing community design guidelines that will be left to conservation districts, and let's rewrite them as the conservation design guidelines. And so we would be able to learn from what DOZA has done, learn from those districts specifically, and sort of close the loop on that. So with that, I'm going to stop. Thank you everybody for listening to me. Thank you for the feedback, Commissioner Zanter and Chair Livingston. And I've got as much time as you've got to talk through pieces of the puzzle and answer questions.
Brandon, is there any way you can make this presentation available for kind of a slower, lap back through it to absorb it a little bit?
Absolutely, and I think that would be helpful if I could look to the clerks or to Tim to get it out to you.
Okay.
We do have a one place in the website that shows this proposed hierarchy with a clear, here are the rules that would apply at each level in sort of that snapshot that Zari was talking about. And so I might ask the staff to forward that out as well.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Maybe so, you could send us a link, Brandon, or I would say send it to Hillary and myself.
Yep.
And then we could get it out to commissioners.
Got it.
Commissioners, we just have a few minutes for questions. I want to be sure before we break and move on to the next agenda item that we have a little bit of discussion about whether or not we think it is appropriate to provide either written and oral testimony at Planning and Sustainability Commission later this month. So questions first, though. Who has questions for Brandon?
I do have a question for Brandon about what changes are being proposed to the makeup of the Historic Commission.
Yeah, good question.
Commission.
This, I've got to pull my code out here. This is something that I really took my cues from Hillary Adam and the current Landmarks Commissioners about new slots that could be added. Yeah. For Landmarks Commission membership. And the idea generally was that we provide some broader categories of membership. I don't know how your commission specifically functions, but the hats that commissioners wear often move around whenever new commissioners are selected. And the thought process was, if we could be a little more broad with the membership, then that would give more options for selecting new members. Some of the thought process was also ensuring that when there were potential commissioners who brought new voices or new lived experiences, that we had some slots that could fill in some different people than we've historically seen. So if you could just give me one second, I'll find that specific change to be able to tell you what it is that we're doing.
Okay.
So more, just really quick, more specifically, this is in the review bodies chapter of the code. The number of commission members would stay the same. And instead of being prescriptive about there being, for example, one historian, one architectural historian, one architect, we would say that five members of the commission needed to draw from the fields of historic preservation, history, architectural history, architecture, landscape architecture, and that longer list. That we have a chunk of the commission reflect those areas of professional expertise rather than one commissioner for one area of expertise. That's the general change. Okay. And then I think you're moving this way too with those that the annual report would go to council in the spring rather than historically in the fall to better allow for a calendar year capture of land use reviews and activities. Also, the Landmarks Commission has felt it is important to be at council during the budgeting process when they deliver their annual report.
Okay. Brandon, does the designation conservation now or in the future bring financial resources or access to financial resources?
It brings no tax incentives. Tax incentives are only available to properties on the National Register, and they're provided by the state or the feds. But the conservation level designation does unlock the ability to transfer unused FAR. And so the most direct tie to a financial resource would be if you are a property and you are designated as a conservation landmark or a contributing or historic piece of a conservation district, then you would be eligible to transfer FAR.
So gold and silver status, which are locally conferred, the only financial benefit that is immediately available is tied to the sale of FAR.
That's right. And this is one of the biggest challenges that I and we have faced, especially in a state with an owner consent law, it's the only one in the country, is that if we want to see special historic places protected, it means that we have to sweeten the pot for an owner to consider that designation. And at present, we don't have financial resources to do that. So think about these use incentives and FAR transfers are the best tool that we've found in our tool bag to do that.
So what is the disincentive for an owner of gold or silver to pursue the National Register status? Why would they not automatically do that?
They might not do that for two reasons. One, the complexity of the application process. So an owner might say, you know, I really wanted to protect a legacy, and we've done that with the land use protections that are conferred. So the effort of putting together a full federal application might be too much work. And two, the National Park Service, while we've even seen locally that there's movement, the National Park Service is lagging behind where we are at in terms of thinking about historic significance and underrepresented resources.
Huh.
And thinking about some areas of history, some resource types that may be eminently landmarkable at the local level because they're associated with a cultural group, an ethnic group, an area of history that is significant to the city, but that might not meet that National Register bar. And we went through this process the last couple of years with a large African American historic sites documentation project.
Yeah.
That recognized that there were very few National Register landmarks in Portland that have been designated for African American history.
Yep.
And the couple that had been designated had a really tough go at making the case to the Park Service, largely because of alterations to the buildings that were done by their African American owners or institutions. And so we went through a lengthy process to come up with an alternate vehicle that allowed African American historic sites in Portland to be eligible for the National Register, compared not against white dominant historic sites, but compared within the register, the roster of African American historic sites. And we just got that project approved by the Park Service in July. It took us about 4 years, but
congratulations.
There's some equity constraints that might exist there where a property, I might use the Darcel 15 Club, which is up for consideration for the National Register. It's a bit of a stretch. We'll see if the Park Service gets there. But if the Park Service said, nah, it's too recent of history, we're not quite there yet, and being able to recognize that history, that may be an area where local historic landmark status would say, absolutely, Darcel 15 should be a landmark. And so we might be a little more inclusive in our thinking as time rolls out. And last thing I'll say too, Chair Livingston, is in the hierarchy and the protections, we've really thought about it again as a sort of nested levels of protection that we, without adding demolition review to the conservation level, which is one of the proposals, the hierarchy wouldn't quite work in allowing an owner to move up the ladder and down the ladder.
Julie?
Sari?
The answer to your question, whether we should testify or write to planning sustainability, from my perspective, is yes. But in order to do that, if I remember correctly, when we were doing DOZA, we collaborated to some extent with Historic Landmarks Commission. We had some joint meetings for discussions and review. Am I correct in that? And I'm just wondering if it's some of these presentations or discussions that staff will have with Historic Landmarks Commission, we might benefit by being present or having sort of a joint meeting to sort of be mutually educationally beneficial.
You know, I was having a similar thought, and I'm going to look to Tim for clarity on whether or not this would be permissible. But, you know, in between now and the end of October, we have a couple of hearing dates, and I'm wondering if we could do, you know, just an hour-long conversation, maybe with a couple of representatives from one or a couple of representatives from Landmarks Commission, so that we can really kind of drill into this and better understand everything that we've learned today. And this is great information, Brandon. It's a bunch of stuff, and we are not expert. And so I'm sure that several of us are going to spend a lot of time studying over the next couple of weeks. And it would be good at some point in the not too distant future, because it's got to happen before the end of October, to have some conversation with some experts.
I think we could do that pretty readily. I mean, short of coordinating your calendars, it's never been easier to hold a joint hearing with you two commissioners.
Right.
So I think that's fantastic. And I'll have a conversation with Hillary too. I know she's been working closely with Brandon as well, and obviously the Landmarks Commission. So absolutely. I think that's great. I think the question may be to you all, would you want to think about a couple commissioners running point that have particular interest and energy to put on it? And we can maybe coordinate a smaller subcommittee, if you will, to have that conversation, or we just do a full on joint hearing, which could be just that much more fuller. There'd just be a lot more voices, which is great. But maybe if we narrowed it to a couple from the commissioners represent, it could be just as efficient.
Yeah. And if we have really broad interest from design commissioners, we could still just invite a couple of Landmarks commissioners to our meeting, presumably. It wouldn't have to be a full commission on their side as well. So commissioners, how engaged are you in this topic over the next month?
I'd like to do your suggestion, Julie. And just from a point of view of just getting more informed about this, I don't feel very informed. So invite a couple of HLC folks to one of our hearings. I think it'd be a great idea.
Yeah, I agree.
I'm supportive of that also.
Am I hearing like a couple particular reps, and then I'll circle back with Hillary and Brandon, and then we can
that sounds great.
I mean, I heard multiple voices. Is it Don, Chandra, Brian?
Yeah.
Is that the crew?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Julie, Zeri. I mean, is it everyone in or
yeah,
do
I'm
you
all
want
I'm
less?
In.
Okay.
Yeah, we want to be educated. And, you know, there's a cross-section between what we do and what they do. And the more informed we are now, and then when we testify or write a letter, we want to be constructive and we want to be helpful.
Cool.
So
we have to know enough to be able to answer questions as well. Right. If we're going to provide testimony, we have to be able to follow through with answering the questions.
So I'm hearing potentially Brandon will get you more information digitally.
Yeah.
And we could send that up right away, I'm certain. And then maybe from there, I guess in my mind, what I'm thinking is we would probably invite design commissioners to attend maybe an extended items of interest at Landmarks Commission's regularly scheduled Mondays at 1:30. I'm kind of riffing here versus scheduling a whole new date altogether.
That's a maybe. It depends on the Monday.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. And then I think that's where it gets to the coordination effort and timing of it all. So let me figure that out, and we'll cast the big net to you all, and hopefully we could catch everyone and then coordinate that with Landmarks as well.
That's great. Okay.
Great.
Okay. Any final questions for Brandon?
Thank you.
Thanks, Brandon. Good to see you.
I appreciate the time. Thank you.
Really informative. Thanks so much.
Thanks for letting me dump a lot of information in 1 hour. I appreciate it. You got the 2 hour presentation in an hour. So
have everybody's attention. We are very interested in this. So.
And with questions always works that way. Well, thank you, everybody. I hope to see you again soon, and I appreciate the time.
Enjoy the rest of the afternoon. So gang, it is 2:53. Let's take a short break before we move on to our next agenda item, which is a type 3 land use review for Oregon Square. Full 10 minutes.
Back Julie, real quick, do we have, yeah? I think we had a testifier for this item.
Oh, do we? Okay, I'll double check the list.
Julie, I have a 5 o'clock conference call I have to be on, so.
Okay, then we want to get started as soon as we possibly can.
Great. Thank you.
Okay, and Tim, you're saying testimony for the briefing or testimony for Oregon Square?
Briefing.
Okay.
I think it was former Commissioner Czarnecki.
Excellent. Okay, let me pull up the list. So the briefing has not yet ended. And I'm getting some feedback on my mic. Sorry about that. Yes, John Czarnecki is here to provide some testimony today.
Oh, thanks, Commissioner. It's John Czarnecki, and I will not be testifying today after all, so you're free to take your break.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today, John. It's good
thank
to see you.
Thank you. It was very informative, of course.
Good to hear your voice anyway, John.
Thanks.
I think we know where the echo is coming from. Do you want to do 10 minutes, Julie?
Let's take 10 minutes. We will come back at 5 minutes after three. In fact, I'll come back a couple of minutes early and begin the reading on the record. And then we will be ready to roll at 5 minutes after three.
Perfect. Thank you.
Okay. See you in a few minutes.